Chapter 15. A melodious laugh she had, I must say. I sat down to my brown loaf, my egg, and my rasher of bacon, with a basin of milk besides, and made a most delicious meal. While I was yet in the full enjoyment of it, the old woman of the house said to the master, Have you got your flute with you? ? He returned. Have a blow at it, said the old woman, coaxingly. ? The master, upon this, put his hand underneath the skirts of his coat, and brought out his flute in three pieces, which he screwed together, and began immediately to play. My impression is, after many years of consideration, that there never can have been anybody in the world who played worse. He made the most dismal sounds I have ever heard produced by any means, natural or artificial. I don't know what the tunes were, if there were such things in the performance at all, which I doubt, but the influence of the strain upon me was, first, to make me think of all my sorrows until I could hardly keep my tears back, then to take away my appetite, and lastly, to make me so sleepy that I couldn't keep my eyes open. They begin to close again, and I begin to nod, as the recollection rises fresh upon me. Once more the little room, with its open corner cupboard, and its square back chairs, and its angular little staircase leading to the room above, and its three peacock's feathers displayed over the mantelpiece. I remember wondering when I first went in, what that peacock would have thought, if he had known, what his finery was doomed to come to fades from before me, and I nod, and sleep. The flute becomes inaudible, the wheels of the coach are heard instead, and I am on my journey. The coach jolts, I wake with a start, and the flute has come back again, and the master at Salem House is sitting with his legs crossed, playing it dolefully, while the old woman of the house looks on delighted. She fades in her turn, and he fades, and all fades, and there is no flute, no master, no Salem House, no David Copperfield, no anything but heavy sleep. I dreamed, I thought, that once while he was blowing into this dismal flute, the old woman of the house, who had gone nearer and nearer to him in her ecstatic admiration, leaned over the back of his chair, and gave him an affectionate squeeze round the neck, which stopped his playing for a moment. I was in the middle state between sleeping and waking, either then or immediately afterwards. For, as he resumed, it was a real fact that he had stopped playing. I saw and heard the same old woman ask Mrs. Fibbitson if it wasn't delicious, meaning the flute, to which Mrs. Fibbitson replied, yes, and nodded at the fire. To which, I am persuaded, she gave the credit of the whole performance. When I seemed to have been dozing a long while, the master at Salem House unscrewed his flute into the three pieces, put them up as before, and took me away. We found the coach very near at hand, and got upon the roof. But I was so dead sleepy, that when we stopped on the road, to take up somebody else, they put me inside, where there were no passengers, and where I slept profoundly, until I found the coach going at a foot pace up a steep hill among green leaves. Presently, it stopped, and had come to its destination. A short walk brought us, I mean the master and me, to Salem House, which was enclosed with a high brick wall, and looked very dull. Over a door in this wall was a board with Salem House upon it, and through a grating in this door we were surveyed, when we rang the bell by a surly face, which I found, on the door being opened, belonged to a stout man with a bull neck, a wooden leg, overhanging temples, and his hair cut close all round his head. The new boy, said the master. The man with the wooden leg eyed me all over. It didn't take long, for there was not much of me, and locked the gate behind us, and took out the key. We were going up to the house, among some dark heavy trees, when he called after my conductor. Hallo! We looked back, and he was standing at the door of a little lodge, where he lived, with a pair of boots in his hand. Here, the cobbler's been, he said, since you've been out, Mr. Mel, and he says he can't mend 'em anymore. He says there ain't a bit of the original boot left, and he wonders you expect it. Apostrophe, with these words he threw the boots towards Mr. Mel, who went back a few paces to pick them up, and looked at them very disconsolately. I was afraid, as we went on together. I observed then, for the first time, that the boots he had on were a good deal the worse for wear, and that his stocking was just breaking out in one place, like a bud. Salem House was a square brick building with wings, of a bare and unfurnished appearance. All about it was so very quiet, that I said to Mr. Mel I supposed the boys were out, but he seemed surprised at my not knowing that it was holiday time, that all the boys were at their several homes, that Mr. Creakle, the proprietor, was down by the seaside with Mrs. and Miss Creakle, and that I was sent in holiday time as a punishment for my misdoing, all of which he explained to me as we went along. I gazed upon the schoolroom into which he took me, as the most forlorn and desolate place I had ever seen. I see it now. A long room with three long rows of desks, and six of forms, and bristling all round with pegs for hats and slates. Scraps of old copy books and exercises litter the dirty floor. Some silkworms' houses, made of the same materials, are scattered over the desks. Two miserable little white mice, left behind by their owner, are running up and down in a fusty castle made of pasteboard and wire, looking in all the corners with their red eyes for anything to eat. A bird, in a cage very little bigger than himself, makes a mournful rattle now, and then in hopping on his perch, 2 inches high, or dropping from it, but neither sings nor chirps. There is a strange unwholesome smell upon the room, like mildewed corduroys, sweet apples wanting air, and rotten books. There could not well be more ink splashed about it, if it had been roofless from its first construction, and the skies had rained, snowed, hailed, and blown ink through the varying seasons of the year. Mr. Mel having left me, while he took his irreparable boots upstairs, I went softly to the upper end of the room, observing all this as I crept along. Suddenly I came upon a pasteboard placard, beautifully written, which was lying on the desk, and bore these words: "Take care of him. He bites." Apostrophe, I got upon the desk immediately, apprehensive of at least a great dog underneath. But, though I looked all round with anxious eyes, I could see nothing of him. I was still engaged in peering about, when Mr. Mel came back, and asked me what I did up there. "I beg your pardon, sir," apostrophe says I, "if you please, I'm looking for the dog." Apostrophe, "Dog?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, he says. "What dog?" Apostrophe, "Isn't it a dog, sir?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Isn't what a dog?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "That's to be taken care of, sir, that bites." Apostrophe, "No, Copperfield," apostrophe says he, gravely, "that's not a dog. That's a boy. My instructions are, Copperfield, to put this placard on your back. I am sorry to make such a beginning with you, but I must do it." Apostrophe, with that he took me down, and tied the placard, which was neatly constructed for the purpose, on my shoulders like a knapsack, and wherever I went, afterwards, I had the consolation of carrying it. What I suffered from that placard, nobody can imagine. Whether it was possible for people to see me or not, I always fancied that somebody was reading it. It was no relief to turn round and find nobody, for wherever my back was, there I imagined somebody always to be. That cruel man with the wooden leg aggravated my sufferings. He was in authority, and if he ever saw me leaning against a tree, or a wall, or the house, he roared out from his lodge door in a stupendous voice, "Hallo, you sir! You Copperfield! Show that badge conspicuous, or I'll report you." Apostrophe, the playground was a bare gravel yard, open to all the back of the house and the offices, and I knew that the servants read it, and the butcher read it, and the baker read it, that everybody, in a word, who came backwards and forwards to the house, of a morning when I was ordered to walk there, read that I was to be taken care of, For a bit, I recollect that I positively began to have a dread of myself, as a kind of wild boy who did bite. There was an old door in this playground, on which the boys had a custom of carving their names. It was completely covered with such inscriptions. In my dread of the end of the vacation and their coming back, I could not read a boy's name, without inquiring in what tone, and with what emphasis he would read, "Take care of him. He bites." Apostrophe. There was one boy, a certain J. Steerforth, who cut his name very deep and very often, who, I conceived, would read it in a rather strong voice, and afterwards pull my hair. There was another boy, one Tommy Traddles, who I dreaded, would make game of it, and pretend to be dreadfully frightened of me. There was a third, George Temple, who I fancied would sing it. I have looked, a little shrinking creature, at that door, until the owners of all the names there were 5, and 40 of them in the school then, Mr. Melset seemed to send me to Coventry by general acclamation, and to cry out, each in his own way, "Take care of him. He bites." Apostrophe. It was the same with the places at the desks and forms. It was the same with the groves of deserted bedsteads I peeped at, on my way to, and when I was in, my own bed. I remember dreaming night after night, of being with my mother as she used to be, or of going to a party at Mr. Peggotty's, or of traveling outside the stagecoach, or of dining again with my unfortunate friend the waiter, and in all these circumstances making people scream and stare, by the unhappy disclosure, that I had nothing on, but my little nightshirt, and that placard. In the monotony of my life, and in my constant apprehension of the reopening of the school, it was such an insupportable affliction. I had long tasks every day, to do with Mr. Mell, but I did them, there being no Mr. and Miss Murdstone here, and got through them without disgrace. Before, and after them, I walked about supervised, as I have mentioned, by the man with the wooden leg. How vividly I call to mind the damp about the house, the green cracked flagstones in the court, an old leaky water butt, and the discolored trunks of some of the grim trees, which seem to have dripped more in the rain than other trees, and to have blown less in the sun. At one we dined, Mr. Mill and I, at the upper end of a long bare dining room, full of deal tables, and smelling of fat. Then, we had more tasks until tea, which Mr. Mell drank out of a blue teacup, and I out of a tin pot. All day long, and until 7 or 8 in the evening, Mr. Mell, at his own detached desk in the schoolroom, worked hard with pen, ink, ruler, books, and writing paper, making out the bills, as I found, for last half year. When he had put up his things for the night, he took out his flute, and blew at it, until I almost thought he would gradually blow his whole being into the large hole at the top, and ooze away at the keys. I picture my small self in the dimly lighted rooms, sitting with my head upon my hand, listening to the doleful performance of Mr. Mell, and conning tomorrow's lessons. I picture myself with my books shut up, still listening to the doleful performance of Mr. Mell, and listening through it to what used to be at home, and to the blowing of the wind on the Yarmouth Flats, and feeling very sad and solitary. I picture myself going up to bed, among the unused rooms, and sitting on my bedside crying for a comfortable word from Peggotty. I picture myself coming downstairs in the morning, and looking through a long ghastly gash of a staircase window at the school bell hanging on the top of an outhouse with a weathercock above it, and dreading the time when it shall ring J. Steerforth and the rest to work, which is only second, in my foreboding apprehensions, to the time when the man with the wooden leg shall unlock the rusty gate to give admission to the awful Mr. Creakle. I cannot think I was a very dangerous character in any of these aspects, but in all of them, I carried the same warning on my back. Mr. Mell never said much to me, but he was never harsh to me. I suppose we were company to each other, without talking. I forgot to mention that he would talk to himself sometimes, and grin, and clench his fist, and grind his teeth, and pull his hair in an unaccountable manner. But he had these peculiarities. And at first they frightened me, though I soon got used to them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.